The American Disease, A Global Contagion, originally published on the 8th of March 2022 on the Anti-Politics Substack. The United States of America is an economic, military, and cultural superpower. This is not in dispute. They impose their will on the global stage through acts of military intervention, economic warfare, and the ubiquity of American mass cultural products, which interface with its explicit propaganda. They have been instrumental in setting the parameters for peace and the global order after almost every conflict since 1914. In this way, the USA has been instrumental in shaping the 20th century and, since the fall of the Soviet Union, has gone totally unopposed as a global superpower, with the burgeoning global influence of China and the reemergence of Russia now threatening America's hegemony for the first time in decades. This situation being seen as abnormal and abhorrent by US elites reveals their near total dominance of the global stage and their expectation of it. They take it for granted. So why then does the USA and the world at large find itself in its current predicament? If the USA has exerted such levels of control globally and the federal government has exerted greater and greater influence domestically, then our current reality must in some way be a product of American will. Why then are so many aspects of domestic and geopolitical reality counter to the stated ideals of the US Constitution and the other sacred founding American documents? Modernity, it could be said, is an American disease, or at the very least, that they are the principal culprit in shaping it. So why has the American reality ended up so unsatisfactory? What is the nature of the American disease? Chapter 1. A Nation of Immigrants. The roots of this disease are embedded in the American self-image itself, both as a people and as a nation-state. The USA, being as it is a product of a multitude of peoples, not a single contiguous culture that has developed over hundreds or even thousands of years, lacks the natural cohesive forces of traditional human society, of traditional human community. By the statements of its own education system, America emerged fully formed as a modern democratic liberal republic without a unique history, mythology, language, or ethnicity to unite those within its borders. The ideas of Americanism and who isn't American are largely abstractions in a far more pointed sense than in the old world, from which its constituent peoples came. In order to become more than a collection of provincial towns and villages, America then must strip its citizens of many trappings of their old identity and inculcate within them this new, entirely fictional, American identity. The more centralized America became, the more necessary and extreme this process of homogenization became. Therefore, from an American point of view, what is and isn't a nation-state is removed from tradition, culture, religion, or ethnicity, and becomes purely a legal fiction. The very idea of white Americans is an attempt to collectivize those early settlers and remove from them identification with their specific countries of origin and their traditions. This carries the implicit assumption that Americans are not necessarily white. And you can see how the idea that race and ethnicity are social constructs naturally follows from this line of thinking. The picture you can see on screen there is from the Samuel E. Kelly Ethnic Cultural Center at Washington University, described as a designated facility for students of color. Because of the necessary abstraction of identity needed in a newly created nation-state, the modern American suffers from a form of metaphysical damage. He cannot conceive of his people outside of the confines of modernity as anything more than a bureaucratic legal fiction or the sum of whoever happens to be within the country's borders at the time. This leaves American identity up for constant debate and ripe for subversion. The leftists, in a very important sense, are right about one thing. The white Americans who ride around in their rascals in Walmart are not Americans. They are a mix of displaced Italians, Irish, Polish, Scottish, and English who would not recognize their ancestral homelands. Their connections to the land go back a handful of generations at best. They are a deracinated people knitted into a mass identity. to describe yourself as American is to surrender to many of the precepts of civic nationalism and egalitarianism. Within the American framework, peoples are not made up of extended family groups who slowly coalesce long before the idea of the modern sovereign nation-state existed, but are purely created and defined by the nation-state itself, and cannot exist apart from it. In their minds, if America as a sovereign nation ceased to exist, so would Americans. Whereas in the rest of human history, we see diasporas of displaced peoples with definable ethnic and cultural characteristics existing long after their nation-state was absorbed, destroyed, or faced natural disaster. To put it more bluntly, unless you are a member of a native tribe with an unbroken provable lineage before white colonialism, you cannot be ethnically American. It is a nonsense. Do not mistake this for a National Socialist invocation of blood and soil towards some Aryan ideal. The very idea of this white identity in the American sense is an attempt to unify disparate nationalities and peoples. The idea of a white race would seem nonsensical to those in Renaissance-era Europe. People thought of themselves as Flemish people, or Bavarian people, or even Yorkshiremen, if they thought of themselves in ways larger than an extended family unit at all. The idea they were somehow a homogeneous white whole did not exist before modern national and supranational identity, especially with many of these groups being historic enemies. Whiteness is the first and foremost globalist affectation. Let us not forget the utilization of white identity in mid-century Germany. It was an attempt to galvanize a nation-state that was even younger than the USA at the time. Modern federal Germany is an invention of the 19th century, being united in 1871 by Otto von Bismarck from various historic kingdoms, principalities, and regions. Greater Germany, as invoked by Hitler, is just as false as the Freedom Fries, World Police, Global American Democracy invoked by George W. Bush. They both exist for political expediency rather than being products of how ordinary people see themselves. These are not traditional identities, these are identities from the modern world. Much like the exact meaning of the Constitution, which we shall get to later, the meaning of American identity seems to shift as often as the presidency itself. This extreme elasticity shows how rootless and amorphous American identity is when faced with the realities of executive and legislative power. This is because, as we discussed previously, American identity is purely the product of the American power structure from its founding moment onwards. There is such tension between the core identities of competing American political factions because people's identities are largely defined by the political power center they give loyalty to. There are not the long-standing ties that bind the American people together that bind many native European peoples together. Chapter 2. The Great Experiment. This metaphysical plague has been exported to places like Britain and the rest of Western Europe in the post-war era as they have been battered by waves of immigration and social degradation in the American model. Nations subjected to large amounts of American influence have begun to see themselves as fellow nations of immigrants, denying the very existence of the various indigenous cultural, religious, and ethnic groups that have made up their societies for hundreds or even thousands of years. Indeed, the very idea of indigenous Europeans is scoffed at as some kind of white supremacist rhetoric, as if the Norman, Saxon, or Celtic peoples are figments of our imagination. They are now only white people, stripped of the finer points of their former identity and history. They are as deracinated as the rascal scooter-bound Walmart shopper. It's a simple point, but one lost on those who would toot the horn of the wider white race. In order to be subjected to anti-white policy, you must first have a collectivized white identity. To play into this dialectic is to surrender to the truly traditional idea of human community. Policy that differentiated between different white and non-white people is something that did not come about federally in post-Reconstruction America until Woodrow Wilson. He was instrumental in codifying the idea of American whiteness that covered ethnic groups that would have normally seen themselves as entirely ethnically distinct. He was also the first president to codify what we now know as Jim Crow into federal policy, segregating federal employees into white and non-white. Wilson was also instrumental in the transformation of post-World War I Europe into quote-unquote democratic nation-states of the American model, most disastrously advocating for the creation of Yugoslavia, out of the various bickering ethnic groups who saw themselves as separate and distinct, deserving of their own nation made up of their own people in the Baltics. Within the British Empire, the idea of white global brotherhood finds much of its root with Cecil Rhodes, spelled out in his 1902 Will and Testament, but still with emphasis on the supremacy of wider Britishness. These ideas are relatively modern and stem from the globalised thinking required to knit together a people with no organic shared history and culture, be it within an empire or within a nation of immigrants. The image you see on screen now is an advertisement in the UK for HSBC, the second largest bank in Europe. It's talking about the fact that because we have a large new immigrant population, that really, Britain doesn't exist and has never existed. And it is a surrendering to the idea of the nation of immigrants. The melting pot has long since come to Europe, a place where it makes no sense. From that point on, it's not much of a leap to the modern ideas of multiculturalism and attempts to knit humanity into a prototypical global state. After all, if you can create a nation of immigrants within the borders of a single state, why then can you not knit all peoples of the world into a global brotherhood? A global American empire would be a global nation of immigrants, a global melting pot in which all are equal, and the nasty ethnocentrism of the old world is done away with. The American melting pot offers no ideological resistance to the idea of a one-world government. The civic nationalism that underpins it is a prerequisite for one. If nations and peoples are nothing more than abstract legal distinctions to be created and disbanded by governments at will, then the global state, of course, led by the liberal democratic might of America, is an inevitability. But legal fiction, in the end, is all the federal government has, and it's all the American experiment has to offer. And there are no pieces of fiction that loom larger than the mythical founding documents of the American Empire itself. Chapter 3. Some men are created more equal than others. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These are the lofty words of Thomas Jefferson in justifying the secession from the British, and are some of the most appropriated in American politics. They're also overwhelmingly interpreted into utopian nonsense in the post-World War II era. The simple fact of reality is that all men are not created equal. In putting on the fashionable Lockean liberalism of the time, in their attempt to undermine the authority of what they saw as a distant and detached autocrat, they sowed the seeds for America's descent into the very mob rule they spoke out against in the other founding documents of the Republic. For when stripped of the sovereign authority of God, whom all the founding fathers saw as the underpinning force of this natural law, you end up with utopian egalitarianism of the most repugnant kind. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness functionally says nothing outside of invoking a utilitarian and utopian ideal. You might as well be reading Bentham. The subjective faith implied in the words of the founders, when viewed through a modern atheist lens, real or invented, creates uncertainty about the exact meaning of the rhetoric employed, and serves as the basis of most of the US political wrangling in political life. And the full-time occupation of the Supreme Court, who specialized in demonstrating that he is sovereign who makes the exception. Did Jefferson truly mean in the modern egalitarian sense that all mankind is equal? Or did he mean all men are equal under God? Did he mean Americans as a people are equal to other peoples in their right to self-determination? There are arguments for each, but no definite answer is laid out. Therefore, all and any interpretations are merely a packed Supreme Court bench away. The redefinition of words and concepts renders the apparently sacred, static, and infallible documents meaningless without the underpinnings of biblical law and the unifying force of the Christian God. The meaning of the Constitution is so elastic that formal segregation of the federal workforce by Woodrow Wilson in 1914, for the first time since the Civil War, and the enacting of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 could happen within 50 years of each other and be overseen by the same political party for similar political ends. All supposedly whilst beholden to the same document, the same laws, and the same tradition. Martin Luther King very famously invoked the words of Jefferson in the pure egalitarian sense when providing support for the existing civil rights push of the Johnson administration. Rather ironically replacing in totality the Lockean natural rights framework these words are supposed to invoke with the idea of government-granted civil rights. The rights of Americans were henceforth purely defined by the current American administration, and the protections afforded by the Constitution were superseded and could be withheld and extended based on the pursuit of racial equity. The only situation in which I could see the Constitution actually protecting an American citizen would be if they had it printed on a Lexan shield, an idea I could probably make a bit of money from. Invocations of it and faith in it have led to the realities of power being obscured from the public under the idea that this couldn't happen in America, even as both the 10th Amendment and the 16th Amendment exist in blatant disregard for one another. The Constitution serves as a living reminder that civic legal fiction, no matter how grandiose in its language, is no substitute for generations of strong tradition, long-standing communities, an organic sense of belonging, and the diffuse power that that fosters. To quote, "But whether the Constitution really be one thing or another, this much is certain, that it has either authorized such a government as we have had, or has been powerless to prevent it. In either case, it is not fit to exist." Lysander Spooner. Chapter 4. One Nation Under God. When you have a culture composed of diasporas, there are no universal cultural values without a shared religion. America, for most of its history, has been an explicitly Christian and mostly explicitly Protestant nation, dating back to the Puritan Pilgrim Fathers and their attempt to create a Puritan land to call their own. As previously discussed, the language of America's founding documents is heavily underpinned by the assumption that everyone understands biblical law and that those who read it place ultimate sovereignty with the Christian God. The Civil Rights era also saw the removal of all religious symbolism, ceremony, and practice, voluntary or not, from public property. 1962 also represented a hard delineation point in the legality of religious activity in state institutions, with the Supreme Court sweeping away what was seen as standard, uncontroversial, and acceptable practice throughout the rest of US history. This was further strengthened in 1971, requiring the subjective lemon test in schools to ensure all activity in any state-funded building had secular usage and the stripping out of the biblical underpinning from America was complete. States, school boards, and local governments simply couldn't choose if a religious bent was permissible within their particular area or remit. The federal government explicitly forbade it universally. Nowhere is this manifested more than prayer in schools. Prior to the 1960s, it was seen as a completely uncontroversial practice within America, something that had happened since the founding fathers. Now it was verboten, illegal, immoral, and outdated. This, of course, is celebrated by the secular liberals as the death of an archaic belief in the spiritual. But where does this leave the Constitution and the 200 years of US law and legal precedent predicated on the ultimate authority of God? Who then now is sovereign, and where does the seat of moral authority lay? Well, The Supreme Court, in stripping biblical underpinning from public life, assumed some of its mythical powers to settle the debates that the faith in Christian ideals had once held. Truly, they could remake reality at will and make the sacred documents say whatever they wanted them to say, no longer bound by the backstop of biblical law. The other answer, of course, came from the civil rights era, going on concurrently. The moral authority was now vested in the people through the sacrament of universal democracy. Gone was the Protestant Republic of old. The sacred now lay in the hands of one man with one vote. As long as the wishes of the majority of the people are carried out by the elected and unelected political technocratic class, and a majority of the Supreme Court held that these ideas were true, then it was true. The letter of the Constitution, the intent of the fathers, and the moral content of the Bible be damned. America from the 1960s onwards was effectively a different nation than it had been before, its identity even more malleable and uncertain than before. No matter what your views on the existence of God, transitioning a largely Christian nation to an explicitly atheist one in terms of policy comes with immense philosophical and metaphysical crises. The very meaning of the founding documents and of the law itself changes once God is no longer present in your reading of them. Those who pull the levers of power gain immense leeway to benefit themselves, as well as immense power by vesting ultimate sovereignty within the government apparatus they control and operate. This view of a sovereign secular government, with omnipotence bestowed by some conception of popular will, is the underpinning of all forms of totalizing managerial state. Chapter 5. 1776 as Year Zero. The founding myth of America, steeped as it is in the trappings of the 18th century, functions as a Khmer Rouge-style year zero for the world history in the American mind. There is a world before American liberty and a world after it. Pre-18th century concepts are then relegated to BA, or before America, the illiberal dustbin of history. Special hatred is reserved for the trappings of aristocracy and of kingship, functioning as the ultimate anti-freedom boogeyman in the American mind. This view of history allows the haggling over America's year zero to give whoever can define the starting point immense power over the narrative of its present and future. Revisionist efforts like the 1619 Project attempt to portray the US as genetically guilty by defining its nationhood by the arrival of black slaves, rather than the lofty political theatre of 1776. This naked act of revisionism simply would not be possible in a place like England, where our history reaches back past 1066 into the mists of Albion and Roman Britain. It doesn't stop them trying, but it is much harder to do in a traditional nation with a much longer history. 1776 functioning as the starting point for the American mind gives them a compressed view of history, having less than 250 years to use as a yardstick of permanence, and with no associated permanence of a bourgeois aristocracy. This is a recipe for a society that breeds high time preference and cannot think on a timescale previous monarchical and aristocratic civilizations. The best way I've seen it summed up is by Julius Evola, to quote, "The opposition between modern civilizations and traditional ones may be summarized as follows. Modern civilizations devour space, whereas traditional civilizations devour time." That is from The Bow and the Club. American modernism, which has existed since its birth as a nation, represents something diametrically opposite of the generational projects undertaken by the rooted communities of Europe. There are structures in Europe still standing that took over a century to complete, that would have been half the entire lifespan of the USA in the 1970s. The particularly American tendency to see ideas that predate 18th century Enlightenment thinking as not only archaic but dangerous has a deleterious effect. Americans are not simply a people without a history, but a people openly hostile to the history of others if it contradicts their own liberal ideals. Traditions and identity are not living, breathing realities with transcendent meaning in America. They are viewed as a quaint theme park curiosity, merely things to be worn like a coat. Perhaps this is why every soul in Boston with skin lighter than a tar pit proclaims to be Irish. There is an innate embarrassment at belonging to this rootless, culturally bereft infant society that needs supplementing by the better defined identities of the old world. They are, of course, not Irish. The closest many of them have been to Ireland is getting in a drunken fight in some god-awful Irish bar no Irishman has ever set foot in. Their surrogate identity is like a child, clumsily putting on their parents' clothes to feel grown up. It is simply a game of pretend. This is what makes American white nationalists so repugnant to me. They do not understand their own identity or their own history because they don't have one. Yet they want to inject their Faustian ideas of a global racial collective into cultures not yet degenerated enough to have abandoned the normal localism of pre-modern life. There are still places that think of themselves as a collection of extended families in a small geographic area. The glowing Wignats should be scorned because they commit the sin of attempting to globalize the American mind and the minds of others who have not yet submitted to the American disease. And I would say that I am firmly attempting to place myself on the right of these people. That line of thinking is how you end up with talk about our white Albanian brothers. Chapter 6. Faustian Liberalism. The language of the founding documents of the United States, unmoored from the underpinnings of their original intent and the confines of biblical law, have also been instrumental in justifying the interventionist policies that have emerged in the 20th and 21st centuries in America. A concept of a global Faustian liberty under an American model can be easily justified by a modern reading of the founder's words. I have here a section from C.A. Bond's Nemesis. This is page 56 if you've got a copy at home. Human rights have gone through roughly three generational developments. The first development was the 19th century application thereof, in which these rights were put forth as self-evident as seen in the Declaration of Independence. I used this quote myself earlier, but we'll reuse it here as well. This isn't part of the quote, this is just a quick aside. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Of course, we've heard this before. These self-evident rights were used as a means to undermine monarchical authority and, in the case of the United States of America, states' rights in the name of the people. In this way, the language of the Declaration of Independence forms the start of some sort of supranational social contract, when seen as applying fully universally. Every ruler that does not follow the specific ideas of American liberty and American freedom and American democracy as interpreted by the current administration becomes a King Charles surrogate figure, a tyrant to be swept away by the liberating and liberalizing force of American might. Where America goes, so does civilization and freedom, and the ever-present idea of American democracy. It is taken for granted that American freedom is the ultimate form of liberty, and that inculcating people into the American way of life is the ultimate good. All they have to give up is their ethnic identity, their family, their traditional societal structure, all of their illiberal customs, their religion, and their very sense of self. The idea that an Afghani goat farmer might prefer sitting in a cave studying the Quran to working 40 hours a week at Taco Bell, only to go home and watch videos of cats farting on YouTube, cannot cross into the collective American mind. They cannot conceive that you do not want to be an American. The image you currently see on screen is from Raytheon Technologies. a banner at a pride parade. Raytheon are the second biggest manufacturer for the US military in terms of drone parts. With the lingering conflict in Ukraine dragging on as a headline issue, we saw Biden's White House press secretary, Jenny Paske, describe Ukraine as one of America's eastern flank countries. This mirrors the language almost exactly of supposed Republican Party right-wing radical Dan Crenshaw's description of Afghanistan as America's flank. Both examples echo a quote attributed to Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1939, stating, "The frontier of America is on the Rhine." FDR refuted the quote, but policy within his government stated this belief loud and clear. The supposedly politically disparate 1940s Dixie Democrats, Trump-era Republicans, and current progressive White House mouthpiece all converge in lockstep on the idea of Faustian American liberalism and the entire world as America's backyard. It is one of the defining features of post-war American hegemony and the main vector by which the disease, with all of its modern symptoms, are forcibly spread, dropping rainbow bombs on Yemeni children, mounting democracy-spreading invasions, and astroturfing mostly peaceful protests and colour revolutions in far-off lands. Here we see the imposition of a McWorld, where the ever-shifting landscape of American values are exported and enforced with a boundless frontier mentality. With no arm of the American political establishment, or even its supposed political fringes, mounting meaningful attempts to curtail it. The foreign wars, child drag queens, dissident murders, mass surveillance, school anal sex lessons, election fraud, lionized race riots, elite paedophile rings, and adherence to globalist lockdowns are all fruits of the hallowed republic and a supposedly intact separation of powers and system of checks and balances, all underwritten by a sanctified and static constitution. The American reality we find ourselves in is the result of an unbroken chain of peaceful handovers of power since the Reconstruction era. America did not lose a war, it did not have a revolution. This is simply the shape of American society, functioning as intended. Chapter 7. A Terminal Patient. Throughout history, you can observe how incrementally, inch by inch, the demise of ideas that, through their adherence to the fashionable liberalism of the time, contained the seeds of their own subversion. Political pragmatism and the realities of power were obfuscated by the language of American liberty, eventually transforming a nation founded on despising foreign overlords into the ultimate economic and military imperialist nation and serial invader. You can see how ineffective at stemming the tide of this subversion are malleable people who forgot their ancestry, traditions, history, and language to become simply a mass of Americans truly are. What then of America? Or even the idea of America? Can it be salvaged? There is constant argument about when the American project went off the rails and at what point it was at its zenith. If we cannot find a single point at which the project was definitely derailed, then resetting it to an earlier form will result in simply succumbing to the same sickness of which it currently suffers. There is also no outside example we can draw on as a model. All Western nations and peoples, not merely America and Americans, have become riddled with this disease. The only way forward I can see is to let the current world die in totality, and forge a new, more local world with new founding myths to ground its various peoples within. A great balkanization. The psychic damage of a global egalitarian ideal must be expunged from people's minds, and the granular nature of stable human community recognized as paramount. The revolution of mass and scale, so exemplified in America and the American project, must be reversed. The self-serving class who steer the modern machine of human misery that is the total American state must be removed. the immovable and eternal must once again sit above the utilitarian and the humanist, and sovereignty must be placed outside of the reach of mere men. Nothing short of a revolution, one more radical and wide-ranging than that of 1776, and a rebirth can prevent the malaise and slow death we all sense in the American system and the Western world at large. For without it, harsher peoples, absent these lofty ideals of self-determination, are bound to write the next chapters of history. It will be they who exercise power over the bewildered remnants of the eventual collapse. With what a poor custodian liberal America has been, I cannot imagine this eventuality will be pretty. I will leave you with the words of James Burnham from his 1947 book, The Struggle for the World. The United States must choose. When the cry of the drowning man has once been heard, it does no good to stop our ears. There is no way to release from this awful responsibility of choice. Pilate's refusal to choose is also, as we know, a choice. Individual men, through the mystery of what our theologians call God's grace, if they fail once, are always given another chance, a chance to repent and choose again. This does not seem to be the law of history of societies. History offers each of its great challenges only once. After only one failure or one refusal, the offer is withdrawn. Babylon, Athens, Thebes, Alexandria, Madrid, Vienna sink back and do not rise again. Nor is there any prior bargaining over the terms and the time of these challenges. It may be that the darkness of great tragedy will bring to a quick end the short, bright history of the United States. For there is enough truth in the dream of the new world to make the action tragic. The United States is called before the rehearsals are completed. Its strength and promise have not been measured and not been matured by the wisdom of time and suffering. And the summons is for nothing less than the leadership of the entire world. For that or nothing. If it is reasonable to expect failure, that is only a measure of how great the triumph could have been. End quote.